I call this meeting of the Civil Law and Elections Committee to order. The clerk will note the roll. And our first item on the agenda is approval of minutes. Representative Dean moves approval of minutes from March 15, 2006. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Members, we have a relatively long agenda today, so we'll get right into it. Representative Tingelstad and House File 2858. I will move House File 2858 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Finance. Representative Tingelstad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This bill relates to international marriage brokers, and I have a couple of testifiers with me here today that can give you more details, but I just wanted to open with a real quick quote that was the city pages a couple years ago. People wondering if this situation really occurs and kind of what are some of the issues related to mail order brides. And this is just a few sentences long here, but it kind of talks about some of the stereotypes of what's happening with other countries and looking at American men bringing women over from other countries. Just real quick, and quote from the city pages in 2003. Why date or marry a Russian woman? American women can have attitudes that are difficult to deal with. They are often demanding and hard to please. Russian women, on the other hand, are so unspoiled. In many less developed countries, like countries of the former Soviet Union, women have a much lower social status than men. Russian men are often abused and disrespected towards women. This is what Russian women are used to. Compared to that, the life you can give her will make her happy and grateful. So obviously, it's dealing with some stereotypes there, but I think it sends a message that some of the women that come over from other countries think that they're going to have a happy marriage here, and sometimes it happens, and sometimes it doesn't, and sometimes the women are kind of put into a slavery situation where their documents are held and other issues. And so this bill relates to those issues, and I'd like to start out with testifier Eileen Herr, and she can give you a little more background.
All right. Ms. Herr, please introduce yourself for the record and give us your thoughts.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Eileen Herr, and I am the Executive Director for the Council on Asian Pacific Minnesotans, a state agency that works for and on behalf of the Asian Pacific community, bringing their voices to these policy discussions. We've been working with the community now for the last, I would say, going on 10 years around issues of domestic violence. And I would be very honest with you and say that a lot of our cases revolve around women who have been brought to this country as mail order brides who then get involved in domestic relations, well, who then develop domestic relations with their spouse or I would say husband, petitioner in the U.S. And when we work with these women, and sometimes they're not just abused domestically, but sometimes these women are also violated sexually in that they are being prostituted out because the husband has total control over these women. And while in some instances, marriage brokers out there are trying to do the right thing, trying to match couples up with one another, there are many marriage brokers that are, I would say, acting outside of the law and for criminal reasons. When we talk to these women who have been sexually trafficked or domestically abused, we ask them, what would have helped you? What would have made this experience much better for you? And a lot of them would say, if we'd only known a little bit about our husband from besides what he tells us, or if we only knew a little bit about U.S. law as it pertains to our own protection, that would have made us more informed and that would have helped us out a lot more in terms of engaging in this marriage. And so what we're trying to do here is that for anyone, a little regulation for anyone who wants to enter into a marriage broker business, that they have an obligation to provide some information to their clients, in this case to women or particularly men who are living outside of the United States, who are then entering into a marriage with a U.S., in particular a Minnesota resident. We see that this will help it'll help a little in terms of protecting vulnerable women from individuals who would seek to abuse them and to act outside of the law with regards to international marriage brokerage. And I'll let it the next, but I'll end it here for questions later.
All right, Representative. Could you please introduce yourself for the record?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Linda Miller. I am the Executive Director of Civil Society, a 501c3 I founded 10 years ago in Minnesota. I'm an attorney. I've been an attorney for 30 years. our organization has received the Department of Justice grant for helping trafficked victims, as well as a U.S. Health and Human Services grant for helping human victims, human trafficking victims. I don't know if you've seen these stats in other committees, but in the last 11 months, we have found 32 trafficked victims, and we are helping them. They have among them 17 children. And I have this available if anyone would want to see it. About one half of those are trafficked, are bride trafficked. In other words, it's another way that traffickers are getting human slavery and human sexually trafficked people into the United States. Almost all the people who are sex trafficked in the United States into the United States are brought in on a visa of some sort, and this is another way that they're getting them in. I have one story. We represented the fifth wife of one man. He had traveled to Cambodia to get this wife and had traveled to Cambodia to get all the other wives sequentially. We represented this woman to help her with, she found out that she was being deported, and she asked why, and they said, because your husband, who she was living with and supporting, divorced you. She didn't know that. So we had to solve all of her immigration problems. She had children by that time, and we had to solve the divorce problems. And while we were doing that, he went over to Cambodia and got a sixth wife. And what he had done with each one of these wives is get fresh credit cards, because they have good credit history, no credit history, and they can get fresh credit cards. And he had, with the fifth wife, he had bought a house using her name and had sold the house. So this is another way that people can be used, and when they don't speak the language, they'll just be used over and over again. So if we can provide the marriage history and the conviction record of these men to the women before they accept these marriages, it will help. In that it may discourage the men from doing this, and it also will help the women make a choice.
Thank you, Ms. Miller. Ms. Cushman, did you have anything to add? All right, any questions for the author or the witnesses? Representative DeLaForest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps a question for the author here. I'm getting the sense from the testimony, am I correct or incorrect, is my question perhaps for the author, that many of these mail-order bride houses, I guess you would call them, are little more than fronts for sex trafficking? Is that really sort of the state of this industry or this business, that these marriage brokers aren't so much legitimate as they're acting as really, I don't know, I guess, international pimps in a sense? Is that what is happening, in your opinion?
Representative Tingelstad.
Mr. Chair, Representative DeLaForest, good question. And actually, it's hard to find some of that information, but certainly from the facts that Ms. Miller has provided, it certainly is happening in Minnesota, and I have another couple of bills that deal with finding more of these things that are going on and educating law enforcement about those issues. But certainly with this type of situation, it can happen over and over again, and obviously it could be a big problem.
Then, Mr. Chairman, just to follow up.
Representative DeForest.
Thank you. If you know, I'm not one for all sorts of governmental regulation things, and, although I admit I don't know a whole lot about this whole mail order bride thing, I would tend to agree that there is definitely a propensity for abuse. I'll be honest, maybe it's my particular worldview, but I just don't see ordering a bride like you would order a lawnmower, you know, over the internet really is conducive to what I think we would all consider to be a marriage. And so I don't know, perhaps why not just outlaw the darn thing instead of throwing so many regulations on it? Perhaps, you know, I'm insulting somebody who has a successful marriage that transpired that way. I don't know that, but it appears to me that I would tend to agree with what I've seen, that this is really more than just a front for what is sex trafficking, and perhaps maybe it ought to just be illegal. I don't know, Mr. Chairman. That's just a comment more than a question.
Other questions or comments? Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would just echo Representative De La Forest. Seems to me that regardless of what you want to call it, we're trafficking human beings, and somebody's making a profit off that. It's illegal under any other form. I don't understand why we're allowing it here and why we want to start regulating it. It seems that it'd be better to outlaw it.
Anything else? All right, seeing no further discussion, the chair will renew his motion that House File 2858 be recommended to pass and refer to the Public Safety and Finance Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Appreciate it.
We are going to jump down, members. We're not. Okay. We're going to jump down to House File 1948, which is, I think, number 4 on our agenda, Representative Holberg's bill. And I think we all got handed, we maybe had a incorrect bill here, but we do have it now. And I will move House File 1948 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This, I'm sure, may look familiar to the committee. You actually passed this bill out of committee on April 4th of 2005, but of course at the end of the session it reverted back to the committee. So I'll give you a brief overview. It wasn't my intent today to provide a lot of testimony, but rather to just get this back to the floor. This is the bill that would limit the use of public resources for campaigning purposes. You may recall that there was a lawsuit. The city or the Lakeville School District was sued by the teachers union. So there is a court precedent in this case that allows school districts to regulate this type of activity in their schools. And the principle behind this is that school time and resources should not be used for lobbying purposes. It doesn't belong in our school environment, and this law would require that the school districts enact such policies.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Did you have any witnesses yourself?
No, right. Mr. Chair, again, this committee heard this bill last year.
All right. Mr. Kite, did you want to come down and give us your thoughts?
Representative Johnson, members of the committee, I'm Charlie Kite, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators, and I'm here speaking for school superintendents. And I'm going to speak somewhat against this bill, because part of this bill has a significant and positive merit, but we also have a concern that we wanted to share with you. I think Representative Holberg is on the right track when we need to be sure that within the schools that we don't have employees lobbying one way or the other for the election of board members. We don't think that's appropriate. We think that we have to be careful in the in conducting our lives as teachers or administrators, in that we don't try to get involved and influence the various pieces that come before the community in terms of elections. But I also share with you that the superintendents are in a somewhat unique position. It's the superintendent's job to represent the board, but it's also the superintendent's job to make the case in a community for what needs to be done for the greater good for education. I speak from personally working as a superintendent for 20 years, and there are times when my job was to talk about the need for funding or talk about the need for a building prior to even the board coming to a decision if they would do it or not. In essence, sometimes it's the decision of the superintendent to make the case for what should happen. And our concern is that we are nervous about a statute that directs policy to take the ability away from the people charged by the board to try to make that case for education. We understand that once the board makes a decision and they call for a vote of the people, that then you have to move into just a mode of informing the public as opposed to influencing them. But that line between influencing the public early on and then informing them later can get very blurry indeed and could become quite problematic. That's one of our concerns. Let me share the second concern that we have. As we read this law, it also pertains to the ability of people who lead our schools to come forward here to the legislature and speak to you in either in favor of or against particular legislation that is coming up. When we go over to the House Education Finance Committee, superintendents are appearing all of the time to both provide information and provide arguments in favor or against different ways of funding our schools. And we're worried that this particular statute will limit that ability. So let me just conclude by saying we think Representative Holberg is on to a good thing here in terms of this business of influencing elections from inside the school. But we are nervous that if we pass the law in this form that it's in right now, it's also going to take away a major part of the educational leader's duty, and that's to make the case for good education in their communities. That's my testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Mr. Kite. Representative Holberg?
Yes, Mr. Chair. First, probably the easiest one to address would be the second concern. This would not prohibit a superintendent from coming and testifying before the legislature for or against a particular item as an individual, but not he or she would not be able to as an employer in official capacity. So it would there would be the delineation there that would be able to accommodate the dissemination of the information related to a work product or work relationship between a superintendent and a school board as far as them making recommendations. I think that's something that we could probably address with an amendment. Certainly we wouldn't want to throttle the ability of the superintendent or the administration to make recommendations to the school board in adopting particular policies. But again, this is getting at the emails that you've all gotten them with the ending of the email, the ISD 194.k12.state.mn.us. They seem to get more and more numerous, and in fact I started when I make my reply an additional question for them asking if this is the official position of their employer or does their employer allow the use of taxpayer funded resources for lobbying purposes, and as yet nobody's ever responded to my question, so I'm not sure what the policies are in these school districts, but these resources are being paid for by taxpayer funding and should not be used for lobbying purposes in my position.
Representative Holberg, I have a question. I do remember this discussion last year. Is this the same bill that we passed last year out of this committee, or has it changed?
Mr. Chair, this is the same wording that passed out of the committee. The bill was amended from when it was initially introduced. We listened to input from the School Board Association, Education Minnesota, and the Superintendent Association, so there were some wording changes from introduction, and I don't recall this particular concern about the relationship between the superintendents and the school board and making recommendations within the context of that work product process, but certainly we can work on that as well.
Any further questions or discussion? Anyone else? Representative Dean.
I just had a question. I believe that it was this bill that precipitated a lawsuit by Education Minnesota against was it Lakeville School District?
Mr. Chair, no, the thing that precipitated the lawsuit was that Lakeville Schools was the only school district in the state of Minnesota that denied Education Minnesota the right to distribute John Kerry flyers in the teacher's mailbox. There was five districts that were initially raised concerns about it. Education Minnesota was able to tender agreements with four of the five schools. Lakeville stood by their policy, which you have a copy of in your packets, and took the issue to court and won.
Mr. Chair.
President Dean.
Are you aware of any other lawsuits? Have they sued any other school districts since that time
year? Not that I'm aware of, but I can tell you from a representative's perception on this. What's really nice is when teachers, and there are some exceptions, some still break the standards, but for the most part, when I'm contacted by employees of District 194, I get the facts, Jack. You know, I don't get the embellishment if they're concerned about cuts to arts funding or in recent weeks, the 70% rule. They will provide me with information and things to consider, but stop short of telling me how to vote or how they would like me to vote on a particular issue.
Thank you.
Any further discussion or questions? Representative Hilke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hallberg, in light of the court decision, why can't we just leave it to the policy determined by individual districts?
Representative Hallberg.
Well, Mr. Chair, we certainly could, but I think that from the experience in 2004, it's pretty clear that very few have policies that address this. And from a state level, I think this is an important policy in setting an environment in our schools where our backpacks aren't turned into lobbying vehicles and the resources and time of our paid public employees are not used for lobbying purposes.
Is that healthy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hallberg, the very first sentence in paragraph A in section 1, school board must adopt and implement a district-wide policy. If you stop there, you wouldn't have to be dictating what the policy is. That could be left up to the discretion of the local school board, could it not?
Representative Hallberg.
Mr. Chair, I believe that would be correct.
Anything further? Representative Less?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hallberg, the question that I have is, if you were to assign a value to some of these things, taxpayer-provided resources, for example, an email. Now, I don't really know this, but I know it is a taxpayer-supplied resource, but how much value would you assign to an email sent off by an employee to advocate for a certain position? Say, one email.
Representative Hallberg.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesch, I don't know the value of one particular email, but I do have information from an employee who is a member of Education Minnesota that talked about the dozens of emails each week they received through the course of the political season in 2004 advocating for particular candidates on behalf of the union to the point where it was a major irritant. And the comment he made is that he was beginning to feel like he was working in a hostile working environment because he did not agree with the admonitions in this barrage of emails. So one or two emails here and there, but if you were to take the cumulative number of emails across the state that are being sent through public email addresses, it would probably be quite astounding the amount of time and money that's being spent to read, address, and respond to those emails.
Representative West?
Just one follow-up then. I think, and I understand that in some cases it gets a little out of hand, and most of us who are government employees are usually pretty careful about what we send with respect to government email accounts because it's closely monitored. But a lot of my constituents, I know, if they happen to work for a state government, they'll get one. They might send one email a year about something they feel strongly about. And my concern is that someone's going to be wrongly targeted because this is kind of an issue-oriented type of deal. And as you stated, it was precipitated by an issue-oriented thing. And folks didn't want to have to deal with seeing John Kerry flyers in their mailboxes. What would you say about a situation where one person sent off a single email once a year, and and they transgress this law because of it.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesch, I think what's more important is that you have the policy. Like I said, occasionally from District 194 employees still, I get the lobbying email as opposed to the information email. It's greatly reduced. But I think what you have to remember is this isn't just about emails. The policy that you have in front of you, I believe on green paper, that the Lakeville School District put together was a result of a number of incidences from school board election materials being taped to the front of desks, from cabaret nights where the teacher-endorsed candidates' election materials were put at every single place setting, in a place where the teacher's lounge had campaign signs in the window facing the student parking lot, to community events in which like a fall community sign-up event in which the community coming to sign his kids for soccer, et cetera, were barraged with campaign literature from all angles, their cars covered with material. So it's not just email, it's what kind of environment do we want for our children in our schools, and certainly we want them to be provided with factual information, but for schools to use backpacks and the school environment for lobbying purposes, I don't think is appropriate.
Representative Simon, can I just add one thing before you speak? This is probably our last meeting before second deadline where we've got a shot to finish in time and not have to come back at night. And this is a bill that we passed last year, so if we could all keep that in mind, I'd appreciate it. Representative Simon.
10-second hypothetical, Mr. Chair. Representative Holberg, if a superintendent is at, say, a Chamber of Commerce breakfast and is asked, Bill, Mary, we've got this ballot question coming up, what do you think? Is that, do you either intend or by the language here, do you think that would run afoul of the language here? Is that considered school time, or in that scenario, would they not be permitted to give an opinion or just say, hey, I have to beg off? What do you think might happen there?
Well, I think in the case, first of all, we do have a law that talks about what school employees can do once a ballot question is put forward and that they can only provide factual information. So I guess it would probably depend in your scenario whether it was before or after it was an official ballot question. Certainly, we never want to throttle the ability of an individual to have free speech. It probably would determine whether that individual was in working in the official capacity as a superintendent at the time or was out for a social setting as an individual. And certainly, once this policy was in place, the superintendent could preface his or her words by, the school district has no official position on that, but as long as you ask, my individual opinion is such.
Anything further? All right. Seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House Bill 1948 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed?
No.
Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee, and I think I'll see you back Thursday night.
All right. Representative Emmer, House File 3076. Representative Emmer moves House File 3076 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. This is some tweaking of the Minnesota Business Corporations Act, Chapter 302A, that myself and Representative Paul Thiessen have been asked to carry on behalf of the Minnesota State Bar Association. The bill is primarily technical in nature. I have the... I don't know what your position was.
The chair of the business.
I have Mr. David Vanderhaar, who is the chair of the business law section of the Minnesota State Bar Association, to take you through the bill and answer any questions that you have. With that, Mr. Vanderhaar.
Thank you, Representative Emmer. Mr. Vanderhaar, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then, if possible, briefly walk us through the bill.
Certainly, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is David Vanderhaar. I'm an attorney with Fabian Benson, and I'm the chair of the business law section of the Minnesota State Bar. Every year, the or every several years, the business law section reviews our business law statutes, in particular Chapter 302A, which is the Minnesota Business Corporation Act, for changes, inconsistencies, technical amendments, and provisions that members of the committee generally feel are widely supported within the business community. This year, there were 17 lawyers that participated in that process. We've met over four meetings and are recommending a number of changes to the bill that are primarily technical in nature. Many of the changes in the length of the bill, which we apologize for, is that a lot of the changes are a result of the really the proliferation of different entities for doing business over the past decade. So while at one time your choices would have been a business corporation or a partnership, today we have limited liability companies. We have limited liability partnerships. We have limited liability partnerships. And a lot of the changes that you see are really definitional changes to take in the broader concept of organization. Some of the things that are a little bit more substantive but still fairly technical in nature include changes that would allow provisions in the articles of incorporation to be dependent on facts ascertainable outside of the articles or by incorporation of reference to agreements or other arrangements, all of which need to be on file with the corporation and available to shareholders. We also would permit corporations to change their names without a shareholder vote and without the need for a merger. This is really, we view primarily as housekeeping. We'd authorize board committees to include subcommittees comprised of one or more committee members. The statute eliminates the requirement that the board, as opposed to officers of the corporation, must approve the corporation's use of uncertificated shares. Many public corporations now have entirely uncertificated shares rather than share certificates. We broadened the circumstances under which a board can decide that matters should go to the shareholders, even if the board has determined that they are no longer supporting the matter or are abstaining from the matter. Several years ago, we adopted a market out to the dissenters' rights provisions, and we've done some clarifications of that provision that was adopted back in 2004. And we've done some clarification of provisions relating to successor liability and asset sales. Mr. Chair, that's a very brief summary. If there are questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you. Before we do that, is there anyone else who'd like to testify either for or against this bill? All right, any questions? Mr. Vanderhaar, as you can see, generally bills that come out of the MSBA's fairly rigorous process are held in pretty high regard by this committee. So unless I see questions, we will. Representative Emmer, do you have anything else?
No, sir.
All right. Then Representative Emmer renews his motion that House File 3076 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Thiessen, see if you can top that. Welcome to the committee, Representative Thiessen. I will move that House File 3073 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 3073 is also a Bar Association bill dealing with some real property law issues, some of which we changed last year. There's a lot of technical amendments in here, but I will just turn it over to the Bar Association representative, if that's okay.
That's fine. Representative Thiessen, is this an amendment that you wanted to
put on? Oh, yeah, if we could.
All right. Yes. I will move the H3073A1 amendment to put the bill into the form that the author would like. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
And, Mr. Chair, I also have one more change.
All right.
If I can make an oral amendment in Section 10.
What page is that?
It is page 19, I believe.
All right.
And we're looking actually at page 20, line 20.
Okay.
And it says 5. If we could change that to 10.
So on page 20, line 20, the word 5 should be changed to the word 10.
And on page 20, line 25, there's another 5 that should be changed to 10.
All right. So on line 25 of the same page, delete 5 and insert the word 10. Any discussion? All those in favor of that oral amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. That amendment is adopted. I'm sorry, sir. I didn't catch your name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Chuck Parsons. I'm a real estate attorney licensed to practice in Minnesota. I'm here as the co-chair of the legislative committee for the real property law section.
All right. Mr. Parsons, thank you for being here and give us your thoughts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could, these are all, I believe, technical changes, and if I could address all but one of the sections. Section 1 is a very minor probate change to eliminate archaic language. The guardian reference is no longer in the statute. And the second probate change, I believe it's Section 14, is to eliminate a reference to Social Security numbers in petitions. The MCIO, well, that's our Minnesota Common Interest Ownership Act, the one that governs condominiums, townhomes, common interest communities. There are quite a few technical changes in Sections 3 through 10. Some of these are oversights, and the change from 5 to 10 days that was just mentioned in the oral argument, that was a result of a computer glitch in the revisor's office. And all of the other sections within MCIO have a reference to 10 days on the disclosure statements that are given to buyers of common interest community units. The provision in this bill with respect to the sale of homestead, which is section, if I have my numbering right, 13, is to clarify an issue with respect to the sale of a homestead. Is that section 12, excuse me, beginning on page 25, and that's a very long section in the statute. The actual change is the bottom of page 27 and carrying over to page 28. It has always been the understanding of real estate and probate lawyers in Minnesota that when there is a death and there is a homestead in the estate, that that homestead can be sold by the personal representative, but if there is a surviving spouse, only with the consent of the surviving spouse. If there is no surviving spouse, then the sale can be made by the personal representative without the input of other heirs, unless there's a provision in the will that would restrict the personal representative's ability to sell. There's an unpublished Court of Appeals case, Hardin versus Patek, that raises a question as to whether or not other heirs would have to be would have to give their consent. And that goes counter to what has been the practice for 150 years. There are literally thousands, if not tens of thousands of sales that have been made by PRs of what was someone's former homestead when there is no surviving spouse and without, you know, any written consent from any other heir. So this clarifies that to make it clear that the personal representative can make that sale with the consent of a surviving spouse if there is one. Otherwise, as long as the will doesn't prohibit it, it can be sold. And because that is such an important issue and affects so many transactions that have occurred already, you'll notice that the effective date in Section 14 on page 29 and 30 makes this clarification. It's really not a change in the law as far as the practitioners are concerned. It makes this retroactive so it would apply to transactions that have closed as well as to future transactions. And is typical the case, there is a savings clause that if someone is aggrieved by this clarification, they have the right to bring a court action between now and September of next year to assert those rights. With respect to the amendment that was added, the A1 amendment, this is an important modification to one of the bills that was passed last year. The court system was working on a proper way of identifying, docketing, and treating the effectiveness of foreign judgments because of course, the full faith and credit clause in the federal constitution. The original bill as directed would have required the court administrators to give the foreign jurisdiction's length of life of a judgment, give that effect in Minnesota as well as the interest rate. And of course, that is a huge administrative issue because from a title standpoint, we all know in Minnesota our judgments are good for 10 years. But if a Florida judgment, for example, would be good in Florida for 20 years, to then make that Florida judgment, when it's docketed in Minnesota, a lien for 20 years becomes a real administrative headache, and the bill that was passed last year would have had that effect, as well as giving effect to the interest rate earned on a judgment in Florida as opposed to the interest rate earned on judgments in Minnesota. We worked with the Minnesota Association for Court Management, and by the way, that section was given a delayed effective date till August of this year because quite a few concerns were raised over that. So we worked with the Minnesota Association for Court Management, the Minnesota Land Title Association, the Minnesota Real Estate Services Association, and the Bar Association to see exactly what was necessary with respect to foreign judgments. The ultimate conclusion was that, in fact, the Full Faith and Credit Clause doesn't require Minnesota to recognize the length of term or the interest rate in the foreign judgment. Rather, once docketed in Minnesota, that judgment is governed by our 10-year limitation on judgment enforceability and our interest rate, and that's much more easy for the court administrators to administer. Can you imagine keeping track of the law in 49 other jurisdictions as well as foreign countries? So this change accomplishes that, and all those entities and organizations support that change.
Thank you, Mr. Parsons.
Mr. Chair, if we could have Mr. Thaden address the last issue.
Mr. Thaden, please introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm here representing the construction law section of the State Bar Association. My name is Gary Thaden. I'm a representative of two construction trade associations, the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association and the Minnesota Contractors of the National Electrical Contractors Association. I'm here on Section 2, Mechanics Liens, which is pages 2 and 3. The construction section wanted to change existing law. Right now, if someone has a mechanics lien on a property and they want to get a release from that lien, they are required to go before the court and post cash in order to get a release on that lien. This would allow them to also post a bond that's approved by the federal government's list to do that same transaction.
Thank you, Mr. Thaden. Any questions for the author or witnesses? Anyone else who'd like to testify for or against this bill? Representative Thiessen, anything else?
Mr. Chair, I'd just like to recognize that Mr. Bob McLeod of the probate section, chair of that section, was also here, but we don't need to. His section's been covered, but just so people know he was here.
Thank you. All right, seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 3073 be recommended, as amended, be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, members.
Thank you.
Representative Blaine here.
Yes.
House File 822. Welcome back to the committee, Representative Blaine. If I remember right, this is a bill that we heard and passed last year. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. Thank you again for allowing me to come forward with the bill in front of committee. And
I will move House File 822 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Representative Blaine.
Mr. Chair and members, many of you probably remember House File 822 before the committee last year, and when I had brought this bill before the committee, we were looking at addressing this issue not only for the school district 482 of Little Falls, but with changes that we had made in the education committee, this would go statewide. And literally what the bill does is that it allows for an alley system in the elections process for school districts in the state. And we're looking at this. We think this is a bill that is good to have dialogue or allow for increased dialogue on issues within the school districts rather than looking at just running versus seats. And this way, when a candidate could file, they could file for a specific position on the school board if they have issues that they feel are different than a sitting school board member or someone else who's already filed for that position. Many of you probably know that this practice is already in place and has been granted to, I believe, four or five different school districts in the state already, and both Rochester and Alexandria currently use this format. The changes that we had made last year in the Education Committee to take this from just applying simply to the Little Falls School District to run this statewide, it was simply to keep every school district, or not every school district, but the school districts in the future from coming and taking up committee time, granting them the same opportunity. So I have with me the past chairman from the Little Falls School District, Susie Sapio, and Mr. Chair and members will stand for any questions the committee may have.
All right, thank you, Representative Blaine, and welcome to the committee, Mr. Sapio. Any questions? Is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against this bill? Mr. Sapio, did you have anything you needed to add?
No, just thanks for the committee hearing it today.
All right, seeing no discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 8820 is recommended to pass and place on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Representative Meslow, House File 576. Does someone else want to move a bill today? All right. Representative Simon moves that House File 576 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Welcome to the committee, Representative Meslow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I don't know, everybody else has done such a great job with their bill. I figure my odds aren't that great. I'm not that smooth. But I appreciate your time, committee members. This is actually a bill that you have also seen previously, and it has come through the committee cleanly before. It is a change in our laws on parentage in Minnesota. These are based upon recommendations out of the Uniform Parentage Act that came to me through former judge, former professor Jack Davies. We have worked on this over the last couple of years. Frankly, these changes are not as sweeping as those recommended in the Uniform Parentage Act. They're pretty vanilla kinds of changes. As you look through the bill on page 2, lines 17 through 21, under current law, a person is presumed to be the father of a child if at any time while that child is under age 18, he receives that child into his home for any length of time and holds out that child as his own. The idea is that that becomes an awfully vague standard, and instead we're more specific in two ways. One is that it needs to happen in the first 2 years of that child's life, and the other is that they reside in the same household for at least 12 months. And if that would happen, the presumption would attach that that person is the father of the child. It still is possible, either by the father's choice or by somebody else's choice, that that child would be determined to be the child of the father. But the presumption only attaches if it's for 12 months within the first 2 years of the child's life. The other change is in the law is that if you look at page 4, lines 26 and 27, it clarifies that what we've got when there's a blood test is that there is an evidentiary presumption that the alleged father is in fact the parent of the child, and that presumption can be rebutted in trial by clear and convincing evidence. So those are the two changes. The rest of them are all simply statutory changes. This morning I had a meeting with somebody from Legal Aid, and they still had some questions and concerns, and we simply agreed that we would continue to work on those before this bill went to floor, if in fact you do pass this to the general register this afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I don't have any testifiers. I'll be happy to stand for any questions you might have.
All right. Thank you, Representative Meslow. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill, for or against? Any questions? Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Meslow, what problem is this solving?
Representative Meslow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilty, it does two things. One of them is that it clarifies that the standard we've got now that simply says that if a person takes a child into his home at any time while that child is under 18 for any length of time, a week, and in that time holds that child out to be his own, then he is presumed to be the father, even if it turns out that he is not. The standard now says that that person needs to take the child into his home for a period of 12 months, sometime in the first 2 years of the child's life. So it strengthens and clarifies that standard and limits the number of people who fall within that presumption. So that's number one. Number two is that it takes the it takes the blood test results and makes them an evidentiary presumption, and that's consistent with what's being done in other states now.
Representative Hilke?
Mr. Chair, Representative Meslow, wouldn't DNA analysis establish paternity absolutely instead of with 99% certainty?
Representative Meslow?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilke, under the evidentiary presumptions, it's not considered a conclusive presumption, and that's why we've got it set out this way as well. In a court of law, those are not deemed to be conclusive presumptions.
Is that healthy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Meslow, when you answered my question, actually, you just sort of repeated what you said in the first place. But what I'm trying to get at, I guess, is what circumstances, can you give me an example of circumstances in which this is relevant and in which this change would be desirable?
Representative Meslow. Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Feltley, let's say that a person, let's say a child is born, and we'll take it in two different circumstances. One is that while the child is still under 2 years old, the mother moves in with somebody for a space of a week, 2 weeks, and during that time, the man holds that child out as his, but the relationship, the living together only lasts for a two-week time period. They then go their separate ways. 3 years later, an action is brought to determine parentage. Under today's law, that man, because he lived with mom for 2 weeks, would be presumed under the law to be the father of the child. That would not be the case if the bill as drafted passes. So that's one of the situations that would change. The other is mother has a child, and 6 or 7 years later moves in together with another man, with a man, and they live together for whatever length of time we'd like to lay out. And again, the relationship ends. There is then an action to determine, and if during that time he has said, this is my child, holds the child out as his own, if an action comes up later, he would be presumed to be the father of the child, even if he and mother hadn't known each other during the time period of conception. That would change under this law, under this bill, if it passed, because then because it was beyond the two-year window that they moved in together. So those would be two examples of things that would change under this bill.
Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, Representative Simon renews his motion that House File 576 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee.
Representative Broad.
Three in a row.
House File 3258. Representative Broad moves that House File 3258 be recommended to pass and placed or re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Finance. And is this your amendment, Representative Broad?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. If we could add the amendment, we can have the bill in the shape that we could discuss it today.
All right. Representative Broad moves the H3258A3 amendment to place the bill into the shape that she would like. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for taking the time to hear this bill. I know that we're on a time frame today in which we'd like to get done, so I'll try to do my part. This bill is an act related to abortion, regulation, funding, and reporting. Based on the authors who signed on to the bill, I'm pleased to report that we have strong bipartisan support for this effort. The bill is very detailed, and I'll just walk through a couple sections of the bill quickly. Section 2 requires the collection of data related to judicial bypass of the 1981 Minnesota Parental Notification Law. This provision will provide a mechanism for us to better understand how well the law is being implemented and how effective the law is in general. In crafting the bill, care has been taken to carefully classify what data is public and what data is private in order to get information without impacting the privacy of the mother. Section 3, in order to make sure that mothers are as safe as possible if they do choose abortion, and in the light of the increasing complication rates, this section will require doctors who provide abortions to have admitting privileges at hospitals within 20 miles. And then Section 4 is essentially the last section of the bill, which is a prohibition of taxpayer funding of abortions. The Minnesota legislature has previously banned taxpayer funding of abortions in 1978. That decision was struck down by the courts in 1994. I know many taxpayers in my district and throughout the state of Minnesota would be very concerned that their hard-earned taxpayer dollars are being used to fund abortions in our state. Mr. Chair and members, I do have with me here today Andrea Rao from the Minnesota Citizens Concern for Life, and she'd like to make a few remarks regarding specifics of the bill.
Thank you, Representative Broad. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Rao, please introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Rao, and I represent Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. I come before you today to urge you to pass House File 3258, the Abortion Regulation Act. Back in 1981, the Minnesota legislature passed a parental notification law that was later upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. The law requires that an abortion may not be performed on a minor unless her parents are notified 48 hours before the procedure or the minor receives permission from a court for the abortion, which is referred to as a judicial bypass. A minor can receive a judicial bypass if she is found to be mature and capable of giving informed consent or if notifying her parents would not be in her best interest, as in cases of abuse. 25 years ago, legislators enacted this common sense legislation because they understood the legal rights and responsibilities of parents and the importance of parental involvement in a child's life. The data collected under this portion of the bill will allow policymakers to evaluate the effectiveness of the judicial bypass component of the law. And according to a fascinating article published in New Hampshire's Concord Monitor, there is great need to shed some light on just how the bypass system is working. According to abortion providers from Minnesota quoted in the article, bypasses are almost never denied. One clinic director said she heard of only one bypass being denied in her 8 years at the clinic. According to the article, when a minor calls Minnesota's Midwest Health Center to schedule her abortion, she is asked if she has told her parents. If she has not, the employee tells her of the judicial bypass option and that if she wants the bypass, to simply allow for 6 hours for her clinic and court visit. Typically, girls are escorted into the confidential hearings by a guardian ad litem, but according to the article at Duluth's abortion clinic, Director Tina Welsh, quote, doesn't let her clients use the court's guardian ad litem because she feels more comfortable accompanying the girls to court herself. And according to court staff in St. Paul, where the Planned Parenthood abortion clinic is located, the courts are becoming overburdened by the number of bypass requests. This is exactly the kind of information that this bill is seeking. Now, if I may switch gears and move to the next topic, which is really about protecting women's health. The number of reported complications relating to abortion is up over 40% in the last 5 years. And this is during the same period of time when the number of abortions has gone down by nearly 5%. These complications vary in severity, but can be serious enough to warrant hospitalization because abortion centers do not provide the necessary care. Based on this information, we are merely asking
that any doctor who performs abortions in Minnesota be required to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital. That way, if something does happen to a woman during her abortion that requires care beyond that which can be provided at the abortion center, she can be admitted directly to a hospital and start receiving care immediately. Finally, I would like to discuss Section 4 of the bill, which would essentially reinstate a ban on taxpayer-funded abortions. In 1978, Minnesota passed a law that banned taxpayer-funded abortions, except in cases of reported rape and incest and to save the life of the mother. A lower court ruling in June of 1994 struck down that ban, and that was later upheld by the Minnesota Supreme Court's 1995 Doe v. Gomez decision. As a result, today, over 29% of all of the abortions performed in Minnesota are paid for with tax dollars. This amounts to over $1 million per year. From the time of the court decisions until the end of 2003, taxpayers have spent over $8 million on over 31,000 abortions. Consider that a 2001 Star Tribune poll found that among Minnesota adults, 59% said they personally believe that abortion is morally wrong. That means that Minnesota taxpayers, a strong majority that feel that abortion is morally wrong, have essentially helped to end the lives of over 31,000 unborn children, and that number grows every day. Some may argue that without public funding of abortion, a poor woman loses the so-called right to an abortion. However, the federal government has disagreed with this notion. In fact, the federal government forbids taxpayer-funded abortions, except to save the life of the mother and in cases of rape and incest, which is the same policy that we seek today. Members of the committee, I do urge you to support House File 3258, the Abortion Regulation Act, and would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rao. Before we go to questions, let me ask whether there are others that, Mr. Stanley, anyone else that would like to testify on this bill? All right, Mr. Stanley, why don't you come up, and then we can take all the questions at once.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tim Stanley, and I'm with Planned Parenthood of Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota. And I'd like the chair's permission to read into the record the testimony of a gentleman who couldn't be here, Professor David Schultz of Hamline University. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, committee members, my name is David Schultz, and I'm a professor in the Graduate School of Management at Hamline University in St. Paul. I apologize that I am unable to give my testimony in person because of teaching conflicts. Thank you nonetheless for accepting my testimony. I wish to testify in opposition to House File 3258. Specifically, I'm here to speak in opposition to two parts of the bill, Section 2, Subdivision 5, and Section 4. I urge rejection of this bill because these two provisions are either unconstitutional or constitute an assault upon the independence of an independent judiciary in Minnesota. In addition, passing House File 3258 as written would be an unethical dereliction of your duties to pass legislation which is clearly unconstitutional and which is aimed solely at inviting a lawsuit and committing the state to spend tax dollars to defend it. I believe that I am qualified to speak on the merits of House File 3258. I hold a PhD and a law degree. At Hamline University, I teach classes on government ethics and the Graduate School of Management. In addition, I also teach state constitutional law at the University of Minnesota Law School, and I am the author of numerous books and articles. In no way does my testimony necessarily reflect the views of my school. I speak for myself, and I simply identify my background for identification and qualification purposes. We live at a time when the independence and respect for an impartial judiciary are under assault. At the federal level, we see judges threatened and their families murdered. We see efforts by the president to undermine judicial review of search warrants in cases of domestic surveillance by ignoring special courts set up to review these requests. We also recently witnessed in Minnesota some in Congress seeking to intimidate federal judge James Rosenbaum over some of his sentencing decisions by trying to subpoena him before a committee to explain himself. In addition, state courts are also facing new threats to an independent judiciary, with special interests bankrolling millions of dollars to unseat judges with whom they disagree. Such a prospect, retaliation at the ballot box for making unpopular decisions, takes on new urgency in Minnesota in light of two court's decisions, the Supreme Court and Eighth Circuit decisions in Republican Party of Minnesota versus White, which now make it easier for judges to announce their political positions, seek party endorsements, and solicit political contributions. Should Minnesota follow the direction of other states, judicial elections will become more political and contentious, and judges will need to think twice about issuing an unpopular decision for fear of losing the next election or becoming the target of the nasty attack ads that many of you in the legislature have experienced. It is in the context of this assault on judicial independence that we must read Section 2, Subdivision 5, and Section 4 of House File 3258. Section 2, Subdivision 5 mandates annual public disclosure of information which seeks to intimidate state judges who uphold and protect the constitutional rights of those individuals seeking to terminate a pregnancy. Among other things, it would mandate disclosure of cases where judges and courts have granted abortions without parental notification, appointment of guardian ad litem, appointment of counsel, and other statistics regarding granting, denial, and appeal of petitions regarding petitions. In mandating this disclosure, Section 2, Subdivision 5 is either unconstitutional or an assault on judicial independence. Section 2, Subdivision 5 may be unconstitutional for two reasons. First, in Hodgson v. Minnesota, the United States Supreme Court ruled that laws mandating parental notification before a minor can terminate a pregnancy were unconstitutional unless there was some judicial bypass option. The public disclosure provision, Section 2, Subdivision 5, appear to be using the pretense of disclosure as a means of intimidating state judges away from exercising this bypass option. If, in fact, the goal is to scare judges away from the appointment of guardian ad litem, appointment of counsel, and the granting of bypass petitions, then this provision of the law may violate the United States Constitution because it undermines the rights and principles as articulated in Hodgson v. Minnesota. Second, under Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania v. Casey, the Supreme Court stated efforts to regulate a woman's decision to terminate a pregnancy would be evaluated under the undue burden standard. For the court, quote, the undue burden standard exists and therefore a provision of law is invalid if its purpose or effect is to place substantial obstacles in the path of a woman seeking an abortion before the fetus attains viability, end quote. Under current law, House File 3258's provisions have as their purpose or effect to place a substantial obstacle on women seeking to terminate their pregnancies before viability, and therefore they would be unconstitutional. Section 2, Subdivision 5 may also violate the Minnesota Constitution. Specifically, in seeking to mandate judicial reporting, it may violate Article 3 and Article 6, Section 1 of the state constitution, which describes the separation of powers among the three major branches of government and which invests judicial power in the state supreme and inferior courts. In effect, it may constitute a legislative or executive infringement upon the independent judicial powers of the Minnesota courts. In the cases such as in regarding marriage of Sandra Lee Holmberg and in regarding the matter of a clerk of court's compensation for Lyon County, the Minnesota Supreme Court has invalidated efforts by the other branches to interfere and encroach upon the powers of the judiciary.
Mr. Stanley?
Yes.
How much longer is this letter? I'm tempted to say maybe you should pass it out because we're getting to a lot of citations that probably aren't.
Mr. Chair, how long have I been speaking? I'm about halfway through.
A long time. Yeah. Okay. You know what? Maybe we should have it copied. That might.
I have copies.
That would be wonderful. If you could give them to the page. Did you have any testimony of your own?
I do not. May I just read the conclusion then, Mr.
Yeah,
Chairman?
Absolutely.
I think that would be the appropriate thing to read into the record. Passage of Section 2, Subdivision 5, and Section 4 would be no more than legislative thuggery upon the courts. They are an effort to intimidate judges and force courts to compromise their independence in the face of issuing potentially unpopular decisions that could be used against them in future election. Finally, in passing these provisions, you would be doing no more than directing the Attorney General to serve as the private counsel for a special interest group at taxpayers' expense. For these reasons, I urge you to reject this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stanley. All right, we will open it up for discussion or questions. Representative Spawick.
Mr. Chair, and to the testifiers, one thing is, or maybe this is for Representative Broad, is you're requiring a lot of tracking in this bill. And statistical information, do you have a fiscal note on this, or do you know how much money we would need to track and document these abortion statistics?
President Broad.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Swalwick. We do not have a fiscal note at this time. I would expect at some point one will come forward, and this bill will be referred to Public Safety and back to House Finance to act on the fiscal part of it. But we do have to go appropriately back through that today. Mr. Chairman, if I might also just respond to one of the items, while it was quite a mouthful from Professor Schultz, one of the items that I did want to make note of on the record is that in regards to suggesting it's unconstitutional in terms of the parental notification law, first of all, I would have to say that the parental notification law has been upheld in court. And then secondly, I would make note on page 3 that all we're looking for in terms of data is total numbers. So the idea that we're trying to target specific judges is just purely not accurate. And furthermore, we've taken additional steps through the amendment to make sure that the reporting is not done by county, but done by judicial district, just making one more step to try to move it away from targeting specific individuals, whether they're judges or otherwise. So I just wanted to make note of that, Mr. Chair.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Broad, I think you just addressed it. My understanding of your proposal, and I had the wonderful opportunity of hearing it in the Health Policy Committee first, is that it's primarily a statistical gathering proposal. Is that correct?
Representative Broad.
That piece of the legislation, absolutely, Representative Emmer.
And it's not designed, Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, your intent is not to create, as Professor Schultz, as his words were read into the record, your intent is not to put an obstacle towards somebody's ability to seek an abortion. Is that correct?
Right.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, that is correct. Our intent is to get information to find out how effective the law is being used in the state of Minnesota.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I just make a comment because this is the second time I've heard the testimony of Professor Schultz, who I have enormous respect for as an academic, very knowledgeable fellow. But in this case, I say to Professor Schultz, if he were here, shame on you, Professor Schultz. Shame on you for suggesting that judges will not exercise their discretion. Shame on you for suggesting that our judiciary is not going to act fair and impartial in every circumstance. Shame on you for suggesting that elections are going to cause judges to make decisions. This seems to be the assault that we're faced with right now here at the legislature and in the public, that people are running out accusing our judiciary of being more interested in an outcome of an election than they are in doing their job. For that, I think Professor Schultz should take some serious self-examination as to what he is posturing, because the public tends to listen. If you say something enough times, they might actually start to believe that garbage. The judges that we have in this state are very independent of both mind and when it comes to examining cases on their merits and treating people with a fair and impartial eye towards the truth. The other thing that I would suggest, Mr. Chairman, is it's completely irresponsible, if that's a word, I think I looked it up recently, not responsible of Professor Schultz to, in the outset of his comments, suggest that this proposal is unconstitutional and then wait until about 2 or 3 pages later, when everybody has been droned to sleep, to suddenly suggest that it may be unconstitutional because of a case that he cites that is completely inapplicable to the situation at hand. I hope that we get to see Mr. Stanley, the wonderful professor, when it does come back to the Health Finance Committee, because it'd be worthy of having a question and answer session with Professor Schultz. Thank you.
Representative,
just to say, I will make every effort to. I'm taking notes, Representative Emmer, and I will give, and as I did in the Health and Human Services Policy and Finance, and he regrets that he's not able to be here, but I'm sure he'll do everything he can to be at the next hearing. Thank you.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. A question for either the author or Ms. Rao. I'm concerned a little bit about Section 4, just from really a technical standpoint. It purports to make illegal the use of state funds for abortions, but of course we have the Gomez decision, and I know that's hotly contested, and many people in this room think it was absolutely wrongly decided. Many people think it was absolutely rightly decided, but it's there. And I'm wondering how you purport to undo the Gomez decision, which was grounded in constitutional principles, not statutory principles. In other words, the Supreme Court said, whether you agree or not, that the Constitution compels this result. How is it that you purport by statute to overturn the decision? I guess I don't understand technically how you purport to do that.
Ms. Rao?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, I guess we feel that, as you stated, the public list is not so comfortable with the Doe versus Gomez decision. And, of course, you know, as I learned in my basic government classes, and we all did, our society, our government, was founded on a system of checks and balances. And we believe that it is the legislature's duty and obligation to represent the people that they represent. And so we have no problem with encouraging the legislature to move forward with legislation that represents the will of the people. In this case, not funding abortion, a procedure which they believe is morally wrong, and moving forward with that. As I stated, the federal government and many other states have come to a decision different than the Minnesota Supreme Court. And perhaps it's been 11 years. Perhaps it's time for our court to take another look at that case.
I guess I'll just ask the more direct question then. Is this bill intended as a vehicle through which the state Supreme Court will revisit the Gomez decision? Is that your intention?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, I would say that was not necessarily the intent of the of this piece of legislation. The intent is to stop taxpayer-funded abortions. But we do understand that the result of the passage of this would be obviously a court challenge. So we understand that would be the result, but that is not necessarily the intent.
Representative
Broad. Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on Representative Simon's questions, our intent, just to follow up as well on Ms. Rao, is that we stop using taxpayer dollars for the purposes of abortions. And secondary from that, our intent also is, my suggestion would be that it's the role of the legislature that determines how we spend the state's dollars, not the role of the court. So I think that it is well within our realm to make those decisions regarding what we fund in the state of Minnesota.
Sam Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I think we should all acknowledge, just for the record, though, that I guess what I'm hearing is an acknowledgement, because I don't think there can be any other position, that tomorrow, if this were enacted, it wouldn't actually be enacted. In other words, we have the words on paper, but there's a Supreme Court precedent that says that a different result is compelled constitutionally. It seems to me that this is designed as or will incidentally be a vehicle for the Supreme Court to revisit the decision, and that's okay, but I think we should understand that that's what this is. Much like the South Dakota bill that passed in South Dakota, this is, although that's a little bit different, still, but this bill seems to me anyway, notwithstanding the comments that were made, to be a vehicle designed for the Supreme Court to revisit it. But I don't think anyone should be under the, you know, anyone should have the impression that passing this will mean that taxpayer-financed abortions will stop. They won't unless there's a court challenge. I think that's the point of constitutional law, I guess.
Representative West?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and my question is for the author, Representative Broad. But before that, I'd like to thank Representative Emmer for his vehement defense of the integrity of our Minnesota judicial system. I'm a big believer in that as well. I just thought it ironic that the plaintiff in the case, which sought to abrogate judicial independence in favor of free speech, was the Minnesota Republican Party. I certainly don't have very much influence with that organization, but there are people around the table who do, so I would encourage other folks to weigh in on that level.
Chair.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I'm getting to that. The question I have for Representative Broad is it the testimony of the supporters of yourself and the supporters of the bill that presuming that this law were enacted and it were found to be constitutional somehow, that there would be no way to track this individual information back to the individual judges?
Well, Mr. Chair, I can't tell you what can't happen. I don't know that you can prove the negative, but the intent of the legislation is to get some total numbers for the state that provide us some information in the areas that are
very clearly designated in the legislation.
Representative West.
Well, I do understand that. I understand that's the intent, but I know that if I were in a position to have a job like that, and I'd have to report somehow. I'm presuming, unless, say, for example, a professor who grades papers, it's an anonymous system, and you can't find out, you know, who the student is, that kind of thing. So the students can't retaliate against the professor. Is there some kind of system that would be in place like that, or would there be some way that if that information were ruled discoverable by a court, that it could be found out?
Ms. Rao.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, I don't believe that there's any way that you could find out. The way that the information would be reported is in one section on under Subdivision 1, the information which relates back to the amendment that we had today. In the copy of the bill, it says it would be by county where the bypass has occurred. It would actually be by judicial district. And so the closest that we could get to a judge is finding out what judicial district they were in. There would be no kind of information any closer than that. And all of the information that is required to be reported by the courts, by the court administrators that could, you know, potentially go back to somebody, those are just cumulative numbers. Numbers of petitions, numbers of cases, numbers of specific things. And we don't have that delineated at all, anything less than statewide numbers. And so I think it would be very difficult. I would tend to say impossible, though I will refrain from actually saying impossible. But I would think that it would be very, very difficult to try to figure out any particular judge. That is not our intention at all.
Okay. Thank you.
President Emmer?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to refrain from taking the bait and arguing stuff that we don't need to argue today. Thank you.
Other discussion on this bill? Representative Broad, anything else?
No, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your time.
All right. Representative Broad renews her motion that House File 3258, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety and Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Broad, House File 2862. Representative Broad moves House File 2862, be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to quickly change gears here. House File 2862 will change the primary dates from the second Tuesday after the first Monday in September to the second Tuesday in August. There are a number of good reasons to move up the primary, and this approach will be both reasonable and workable. Some would argue that we should really move up the primary to June, but that brings with it a number of difficulties that I think will engage us in significant debate. Moving the primary to August moves us in the right direction, and again, will help us do a number of things, one of which will help the administration of the absentee ballots for military voters. Right now, we have a 30-day absentee ballots are sent out 30 days before the general election. This moving up of the primary will enable us to move that to 45 days, which in my mind is going to be much easier and more workable and more fair to the military voters that we do have. And secondly, it will also provide additional scrutiny for overall general election practices and preparations in the area of increased scrutiny that we do have. I think this is the middle ground. It'll help with administration of elections in general. So, Mr. Chair, that's the testimony that I have for you today.
All right. Mr. Hansen?
Thank you. I'm Jim Hansen. I'm with the Office of the Secretary of State. And the Secretary of State's office supports this move to an August primary for several reasons. Number one, it is easier for us to prepare ballots or for our local county election officials to prepare the ballots needed in order to do that. Currently, under the current status, there is a potential of 15 days before they can even start preparing ballots after a primary election, and that's because they have 3 days for canvassing, an additional 7 days for a state canvass if it goes to a state situation, and then 5 days for a contest period for a primary. And so you're looking at a situation there that right there you shorten a time frame in order to prepare ballots, and it gives you about 13 days to prepare ballots and have them ready after all that time period has elapsed, provided there is actually no contest. Okay, so we're assuming a clear case, no contest. They have 13 days to prepare the final general election ballots to be used before they have to be ready for absentee ballots 30 days prior to the election. It's a very short, tight window for election officials. They've been doing a wonderful job preparing it and getting it done, but it is a short time frame. And if there's a contest, that can even be shorter and much more difficult in order to do the process. By moving this to August, it does expand that ability to have a little bit more time to prepare the ballot. It's just more efficient for the election divisions in order to do that. Secondly, as Representative Broad has said, it offers that ability to lengthen the time period when absentee ballots would be made available for not only for our local residents, but for those who are overseas. A 30-day turnaround for an overseas ballot into a military zone is very difficult, given the regular mail system of the United States Air or United States Army and the military. A 30-day turnaround is an awful quick turnaround for them in most cases. So this was the 45 days would be much more appreciated, and I know that the military has asked us to try to lengthen the time between a general and a primary election for that purpose.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Hansen, do we have cases ongoing where people aren't getting the job done?
We don't have
What's
cases.
The problem?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, we currently do not have any instance, and I know that the county auditors are not doing their job or the local elected officials are not getting their job done in order to get absentee ballots out in the 30-day time period. But they are definitely pressed. But we do have instances that absentee ballots are not returned in time from overseas situations to be counted. Now, whether that's because they applied late or because of other issues, I'm not sure. But we do have absentee overseas ballots that don't make it in time to be counted for our election. Yes.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hansen, that we have some that don't get counted. Given that primary elections, you really don't have a very good voter turnout, totally, and not the probably not the right terms, but you get what I'm saying. You know, what are we talking about, a cost versus benefit on making this 30-day change? Or what's the Secretary of State's office?
You mean as far as
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Hansen, we're actually going to have even fewer people show up in August than we will in September. There aren't many people that are on vacation in September when school started. They're back to the point of their life where there's structure. In August, there's a big share of the population that is still pretty schizo out there. So what's going to be the voter count if we switch something like this?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, I think that probably somewhat depends upon what the contest is on the election in regards to the primary, whether in the minds of the citizens there's a great deal of contest in the election. Last election we had primary voter turnout of about 7%, if I remember correctly. So it is quite low. I'm not sure that there was really any real strong contest in the primaries except for in certain regions. And where those regions had strong contests, then the voter turnout was higher. So I think somewhat it's dependent upon what the public perceives to be the real contest in the election. They still have the opportunity as travel to be able to vote absentee in that process, too, if they would like. So there may be an increase in absentee ballots being cast in the primary under the circumstances.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Nelson, in regards to your cost-benefit analysis, I think, if you're talking about people from overseas not being able to have their votes counted, I think the benefits definitely outweigh the costs, the way I look at that. And then secondarily from that, the research that we have shows that both Colorado and Michigan have August primaries. Michigan has a similar recreation state feel to Minnesota, and it appears to work very well there. And Colorado has a similar, where they have one large metro area and a similar population size to Minnesota, and it works well there, too. So I think we're covered. I think it's going to work well. And wouldn't it be nice if we, our Minnesota get-together, where we have the more people in one place, they'd have the general election candidates to have strong debates. And I think that any time we can move the debates forward and get people informed, that's a good thing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, I think Mr. Hansen got what my cost-benefit was. My cost had nothing to do with dollars and cents. In my mind, the cost was even fewer than 7% of the total population showing up to vote. That's a cost to me. Fewer people being heard. And so I'm sorry if I didn't speak clear enough for you.
Representative Clower.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Broad, I think it's a good idea. I think you have your costs and your benefits. I mean, one benefit would be, as the party that often has primaries, we'd have an extra month of unification, which I think would be a great thing on our side. But I'm kind of wondering, what is the status of this bill in the Senate, and is it moving?
Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Slawick, I believe it's been introduced by Senator Higgins, and I assume at this point that she'll be moving it forward. Just to be clear, there was a bill that was defeated for a June primary, but it's a very different bill, and that bill has been now set aside. This is a new approach over in the Senate. This is, I think, in my mind, the way to move things forward in a way that's both workable and manageable. And, Mr. Chairman, I just did want to let you know that Mike Franklin from the Minnesota Chamber does have some comments, if you'd be willing to hear his comments.
Come on down. Please introduce yourself for the record and give us your thoughts.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I am Mike Franklin. I'm the Elections Policy Manager at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Just briefly on this bill, we support House File 2862. Actually, we're one of those groups that has a policy this year that supports a June primary. And we have a variety of reasons why we think moving the primary date sort of north would be beneficial to businesses and, frankly, to employees. I think the most compelling reason that still applies to the August primary would be it allows more time for voters to learn about candidates that are standing for election in November. And the August primary, again, we support a June primary, but the August primary would give us four more weeks to learn about candidates for office in November. And for us, anyway, that's the most significant reason to support the June primary. I think that applies here as well. So we do support House File 2862 and encourage you to pass it today.
Thank you.
I'm happy to answer any questions as well.
All right. Representative Hilty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to mention, if you had not observed, I'm the second author on this bill. And one of the things that I think should be mentioned that has not come up yet is that, of course, with Minnesota moving to implement all of the requirements of the Help America Vote Act, we're going to be distributing assisted voting devices in every precinct in the state, as well as some other electronic voting precinct tabulators that have not been used in some parts of the state. And all of these devices are going to involve additional programming. One of the considerations that that makes this bill desirable is that I've had contact with a number of elections officials across the state, and they're very much concerned about how much time they have to accomplish the simple programming tasks involved with this additional equipment, relying on vendors to do that programming in some instances. Minnesota is not the biggest customer for those vendors, and the additional time is something that I know that the elections officials would greatly appreciate just for that reason.
Any further discussion? Anything else, Representative Broad?
No, Mr. Chair. I just will note, though, that this the measure was actually put forward by the Task Force on Legislative Reform as one of their recommendations, and this was a bipartisan effort, I believe, which was chaired by Chris Georgakis and Senator Roger Moore.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, Representative Broderick moves her motion that House File 2862 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you. And finally, we may actually do this. Representative Broad, House File 333. Representative Broad moves House File 333 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. Representative Broad.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I want to just thank you again for the time and also make note that this bill is something that I've been working on with Representative Flawless, who has authored a similar bill, and we've been working together to bring this bill forward. There's all sorts of reasons to move toward a staggered term here for our senators in Minnesota. Create some better continuity and some more accountability to voters. So, Mr. Chairman, I guess with that, I won't say too much. We are one of only 11 states that don't have staggered terms for our senators. Of the 38 states that do have four-year terms for senators, 27 of them are staggered. U.S. Congress staggers terms. It's good government, and I would really appreciate moving this forward, Mr. Chair.
All right. Is there anyone... Franklin, do you want to testify on this?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I'm still Mike Franklin, Elections Policy Manager at the Minnesota Chamber. This is another one of the proposals that our Elections Reform Task Force decided to include in their Elections Reform Policy this year. Actually, it was a policy of the Chamber even predating this year, but it's part of the sort of accountability measures that our members asked us to respond to based on the last couple of legislative sessions. We think that staggering terms of senators would accomplish a few things. It would sort of preserve the body as sort of one half would act as trustees, keeping the body intact and sort of keeping them immune from political movements of the day, and the other half would be sort of acting as delegates, sort of being accountable directly to the voters that November. And it would strike a pretty good balance. Almost, I guess, wouldn't be exactly half, but half of the body would sort of represent each one of those definitions. Representative Broad already mentioned that of the 38 states with four-year Senate terms, 27 already stagger them. So the Minnesota Chamber thinks this is a pretty sensible piece of legislation. We support it, and we'd ask that you would support it as well. Thank you.
Is there anyone else would like to testify for this bill? Any questions? Anything else, Representative Broad?
No.
All right. Representative Broad renews her motion that House File 333 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on State Government Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. And we have a minute to spare. We're adjourned. Thank you, members.